Hello, everyone, and welcome to Real Blend, a podcast that knows every single Infinity War spoiler, but will not reveal any of them today, we absolutely promise. My name is Sean O'Connell. I'm the managing editor here of Cinema Blend, and as always, I'm joined by my beloved co-host, starting with Jake Hamilton from Fox 32 in Chicago. Jake, how are you?
I'm doing well, and yeah, unlike Forbes magazine, we will not be revealing all of the Infinity War spoilers. Because we're not douchebags.
Super disappointing. I mean, there's no reason for that piece to exist. We will throw them under the bus later, I'm sure. But first, Kevin McCarthy, the entertainment reporter from Fox 5 in Washington, D.C., joins us as well. Kevin, how are you?
Sean, Jake, Gabe, good afternoon to you guys, and Dunkirk. Get that in early this time, that's all.
Today, for all of you, we are going to be reacting to Avengers Infinity War, which is the biggest movie of the year, without question, and arguably the biggest movie in the Marvel Cinematic Universe. We're going to be reacting to the film and discussing it and giving you our opinions on it without spoilers. Like, that's something I want to emphasize right off the bat. If you've tuned into us live on the Facebook page, if you downloaded us later and you haven't seen the film yet, we're going to be able to get into some discussions about it without giving it anything away. Very, very important to note, you need to experience this film for yourself on the biggest screen possible, and we are not here to ruin it for you.
And we're all professionals. I mean, we all know what we're doing. We're not going to give anything away. If you're tuning in, you're like, oh, I'll tune out later on. I mean, we have all reviewed the film. Jake and I reviewed it today on television. It's very simple to review this movie without spoiling anything. I mean, the spoilers are so obvious that we're not going to get into that realm.
No.
So it'll be fun.
And we're going to do a podcast next Monday, another live one, where we will, since it's been open and we assume that a lot of people are going to go opening weekend, we will use that one to dive into all of the open discussions where we talk about everything that happened, because believe me,
Now, is that too soon? Jake and I discussed this a lot sometimes, or we've discussed it before, about when is the realm of when you can talk spoilers. Right. And I think obviously, by Monday, there's going to be a lot of YouTube videos up of people doing spoiler reviews, and we'll have a thing. But when can you talk about it?
But there's a difference between, like, hey, we are all agreeing and warning you ahead of time that we're having a spoiler-filled discussion,
right,
and walking into your place of work and screaming out loud, so can you guys believe that this person died? Like, there,
yeah.
It's all about, like, the pre-warning ahead of time. And I think at least allowing people to have the chance a couple of days before we give them a heads up that we're going to have a spoiler discussion, I think is more than enough time.
Totally.
Yeah, and I think the title of our podcast probably will be Spoiler Review of Infinity, whatever Gabe's going to title it. But yeah, I think you're right. I think if there's a casing before it showing that. But as we've said earlier, there's been articles that are already out that still do that.
Oh, dude.
That list every spoiler. I'm like, why?
In the comment section, underneath our review on Cinema Blend, people just listed a list of spoilers. Like, I'm in there just deleting things.
Really?
Constantly.
What's wrong with people? The day Force Awakens opened, I posted my review. It was completely spoiler free. And some guy or some person posted a comment in my review of an image of Han Solo dying.
Kevin! Why would you give that away?
Oh, come on. that's like spoiling The Sixth Sense at this point. But no, but seriously, like, I was like, first of all, why do people live to do that? I don't get, and that, we're talking about Force Awakens. I'm talking about like 2-3 years ago.
Yeah.
But I don't understand when people live to ruin things for people.
I just imagine that, like, you know, not to get too deep into this or too heavy, that, like, we're talking about people that just have genuinely so little going on with their lives that they have to, they enjoy that.
Right.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah. Anyway,
well, we're going to get into our conversation about Infinity War in a little bit, but let's start like we normally start, and we'll dive into some of the biggest news of the week. I want to get your guys' opinions too. So I'm in Las Vegas. For people who are watching the feed, I'm in a hotel. That's not my normal background. You're wondering why there's beds there. I'm here for CinemaCon. There's a ton of footage dropping at all these different panels. For people who don't know what CinemaCon is, it's a convention that's geared towards the theatrical experience. It's held by, I think it's sponsored by NATO, the North American Theater Owners. And it's specifically geared towards, like, here's all the great films that are coming to your theaters later. Here's what's going to get people excited about why they want to come back to your theaters. It's all about seeing movies in the theatrical experience and the communal experience of seeing these big theaters, seeing these big movies in theater. So every studio comes.
Is there an element of screen competition? Like, when people go, are they sort of trying to hope that, hey, like, doesn't this look cool? You should give us a couple of more screens than maybe you give the other movie.
I'll tell you what's really funny. Sony's chairman, Tom Rothman, was teasing that Jumanji 2 is definitely going to come December of 2019. And in announcing that, he says, so don't give so many screens to Star Wars Episode 9.
Wow. Because we're coming. There you go. That answers my question.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. And clearly there with that information, and we all know Jumanji 1 opened up against Last Jedi. And to me, that was probably one of the most brilliant marketing decisions in the history of movie making, because why would you open a film that close to Star Wars The Last Jedi? And as we know, the movie almost made $1 billion at the box office and was very well received. That to me was just like counter programming at its finest.
Well, and Greatest Showman entered into that phrase.
To me, Greatest Showman is a perfect example of counter programming.
Oh, no, see, Showman did very, very well, but Jumanji was legitimately... What date did Greatest Showman open? It was around the same time as Jedi, right?
20th, 1st, somewhere.
That movie did not have the success... I mean, it was very successful. Obviously, it had legs, but it didn't make $1 billion like Jumanji did.
Right.
I mean, Jumanji made $945 million. I think Greatest Showman did $400 million, which is still amazing. But, I don't know, to me... That was amazing that they did. What Star Wars opens the 2019 December? Which one
episode
is that?
Nine.
Is that episode 9. Episode 9. Oh my God, that's crazy.
What a big month that's going to be.
And it's
be,
subtitled,
right?
Star Wars Episode 9. Here's all the characters left you don't care
well,
about.
Well, but also, right. And let's talk about Jumanji 2 for a second. Like, even if they
it's
bring
so
back...
true!
Even if they
I don't care about Episode 9!
Even if Jumanji brings back all those characters again, I don't really know that we can guarantee that they're going to replicate that success.
No, that was... I'd argue that was lightning in a bottle. I mean, that was...
It could be great.
A little
it?
Bit on nostalgia.
But Jumanji... The movie wasn't great. It was just good. So it was one of those weird things where I don't know... How to explain
it
why
played,
it made $1 billion.
It played
dollars.
Great for families.
It was,
right.
Yeah, it was an easy
really
watch.
Good. My kids
for
dug
families
it a lot.
That didn't want to go to a musical, or for people that had already seen Star Wars and didn't like it enough to go a second or third time, it was an easy, like, hey, you got four or five kids. No right. one's here's the problem. Is it no
four
one's gonna
or five
hate
kids.
You
Jake,
much.
What are you doing?
I don't know. Maybe you're Mormon. So like
10 kids, you bring them to Jumanji.
Yeah. So but like seriously, like no one's gonna walk away. Absolutely adoring Jumanji. It's not going to be the greatest film anyone's ever seen, but no one's going to hate it.
Did you hear this, Rock?
Right, it was fun.
Which is kind of what you want.
Right. Yeah. Okay, listen, we got to get to some news. I wanted to ask you guys about the Venom trailer.
The news!
Specifically the Venom trailer that dropped at the Sony panel. Okay. All right, so we know how Jake feels about it. Is anybody getting excited about this project? Are they doing anything to win you over to the fact? We finally did see Venom in his finished form briefly. The suit comes over Tom... Hardy, I almost said Tom Holland, and the giant tongue comes out.
See, as it should be, Tom Holland.
Right? Shouldn't it connect to Spider-Man somehow?
Yes.
I'm still not on board with this yet, but what about you guys?
I had a hard time getting through the trailer, to be honest with you.
Oof. Me too.
Kevin, didn't you tell me that like you had to finish the trailer because you had
to
finish? Like how bad is that you stop a 2-minute trailer?
It's bad. That's really bad.
Like that's not a good sign.
No, it's not. Why? It just didn't interest you? Like whatever was happening, it looks kind of like
there's
someone tweeted
in there that I hadn't seen before.
Someone tweeted today and they said Venom looks like the best Marvel movie released in 1995. And I was like, yeah, I can kind
of
see
that's
that.
That's a great way of putting it. Yeah. And honestly, like I was looking forward to looking at it and going, see Spider-Man 3, that's how you do it.
Yeah.
And I looked at it and went, yeah, it kind of looks like Spider-Man 3.
Yes, it did.
See, listen, so Spider-Man 2, Doc Ock style, is my favorite Spider-Man of all of the Spider-Man
Dude,
films.
Alfred Molina is a genius.
It's just an amazing film. And I mean, I'm a huge Sam Raimi guy, so I didn't hate 3 like everybody else did. I found 3 to be tolerable. I also found Topher Grace's Venom to be pretty awesome. It was just an overly complicated film.
I'm going to have to disagree with you there, but I get what you're saying.
But I actually saw some side by sides of Topher's Venom versus Hardy's Venom, and I still prefer Topher's Venom only because I thought it looked cooler. But I think the Venom movie is there's too much. First of all, there's so much going on, obviously, with the MCU and Spider-Man and all the connections and things like that. Like the idea that it's not connected also kind of bothers me. But though that shouldn't factor into how we feel about a movie because. That's just behind-the-scenes stuff that we know about. Right. I mean, like, a general person going to see Venom might not understand the interworkings of the MCU and how Feige doesn't have this Venom in this universe. I don't know. But I just didn't find the trailer to be that great. I also found Hardy's voice to be like kind of irritating. Was it? Did you notice like
he might have the most criticized voice in the history of Hollywood. This poor guy.
And I love Tom
win.
Hardy, but he really, I mean, listen, I'm all for Tom Hardy dialogue and speaking. He's great in Inception, but I think I've gotten so used to his characters being so silent, specifically with, you know, with Mad Max. I mean, I think he's a great actor with his eyes and his face. I mean, you watch everything he does, even in as Bane. I didn't love Rises, but he's great as Bane. I don't know. I just didn't find the trailer to be intriguing, and I didn't think that it did anything for me. And also the end shot, which is cool looking, it looks CGI beyond belief. Like, it's very CG.
All right.
Like, almost like too CG. It looks like too computer graphics.
And not to, like, get too much into this, because, you know, this isn't their fault to do with the rights, but, like, how do you have a Venom movie without that? That's like having a Venom movie without Spider-Man is like having a Joker movie and never referencing Batman.
Well, and you
like,
might get like, that, what, right? Isn't Todd Phillips doing a Joker origin movie? Like, this is where we're going. These villains are becoming their own entities, and they're separating
themselves.
This
is why we can't have nice things.
But it's true. I know. I agree with you 100%. I don't necessarily need to see
it. No, I guess, I mean, what is the alternative? Suicide Squad? So, I mean, what do I know?
Here's the thing. This movie could be great, and, you know, this is all based on trailers and speculation and things we've heard. I think Tom Hardy is a great actor. Warriors. Another great movie, by the way.
Oh, it's great.
Love it.
And so, I mean, we've seen him do great performances. I think we are so saturated right now with what's going on with Infinity War, Han Solo, Ant-Man and the Wasp. And, like, a lot of things are coming out in Jurassic World. It's hard to think that far ahead into the year and be excited for Venom. So I think once we get past the summer, when does Venom open?
October.
All right. So I think
like a week before Halloween.
We'll feel a little different about it.
The movie Halloween.
Come August, September, I think.
All right, huge vote of confidence for Solo in that in a Hollywood Reporter story about Alden Ehrenreich's preparation for it, it's been confirmed that he's signed on for 3 Han Solo movies. Vote of confidence for what he accomplished in the movie or overkill and just Disney trying to lock him up?
I don't really think it's either. Like, don't they just sort of do that just to kind of have him?
I guess.
Just in case?
Yeah, I guess. But I didn't realize that they planned on doing that many. So I thought the Solo movie was a one-off. I didn't realize it was going to be an extension. Unless they're going to use the character in someone else's film, which is possible. Like, he could just show up as Solo in someone else's movie.
Right. Like, if you have a Lando movie, he could show up.
Could do that.
Yeah. I mean, it's a great question. I think the Lando movie is definitely a massive possibility because I think that everybody... I mean, I was in Disneyland... earlier this week, and I bought a Lando Funko doll because I was like so excited to see Lando as a Funko doll, Donald Glover. I was like, this is so cool. Right. So I think that's definitely a possibility. I will say this: when I heard the story about him having a three picture deal, it reminded me of the story that came out about Rian Johnson before Jedi about him signing on to a 3 picture Star Wars side deal, right? Because so to me, it was almost like people took that story initially as Jedi must be so amazing that Disney offered him 3 other films to do.
Sure.
So I don't know that. Yeah, I think I'm with Jake. I don't know if it's supposed to show you confidence in what happened in the story or what happened in Han Solo. But I don't know. Listen, I think the tides have turned for Solo for a lot of people. I'm actually getting more and more excited about it now.
Yeah, you are.
The newer, more footage. I also just kind of, I feel like it's kind of an underdog now. And I know it sounds strange, but a Star Wars movie is kind of an underdog. I think that it's gotten to a point where there was so much negativity surrounding it that now it's kind of surfacing as this, like, hey, we might be awesome kind of movie.
Well,
and I think that there's going to be, I really think I'm starting to feel this, that people are going to walk out of that movie and going, it's awesome.
So,
and I think Jake's been saying that too. So,
as part of the Disney panel, they showed the first full scene. Something, you know, that was hinted at in the trailers, but we actually got to see it play out. And it was Han playing Lando for the...
Meeting Lando, right?
Playing the game of Sabacc to win the rights to the Millennium Falcon. And so here's the positives. The positive is that Donald Glover is amazing as Lando Calrissian. Like, from the minute he starts speaking, he's the character. Like,
perfect.
You just hear Billy Dee Williams, and he's not doing an impersonation. It's literally just a continuation of the character, but a younger version of him. I also don't feel that Alden Ehrenreich is trying to do a Harrison Ford impersonation anymore. It's starting to feel like his character, right? Or maybe I'm just getting used to it and I'm getting over it. One thing that really bothered me about it, though, is that, and it's Bradford Young, who's a brilliant cinematographer. It looks dirty and dark. And have you guys noticed? Have you looked at the promo images?
Yeah,
of it?
I like it. Yeah,
I like that too. I want gritty.
I disagree. And it looks weird.
I want gritty. Oh no! It should be dark and gritty. I mean, first of all, you have to imagine. Think about your mindset of 1977 Star Wars,
right.
And then you got to rewind. How many years prior to the original Star Wars is this? 10. Like 30?
10 years.
Oh, 10 years before?
It's only 10?
Yeah. Because Han Solo was supposed to be 29 in A New Hope, and he's supposed to be 19 in Solo.
See, now that bothers me because how old is Aaron Reich in this one? 19?
The character is supposed to be 19.
Interesting. I didn't know that.
Is there really a 10-year jump in look there to Ford? That seems kind of strange to me.
Not really. No.
I mean, in actuality, it's another person jump to Ford.
No, I know. I'm just thinking in my mind. I thought this was a much younger Han Solo. I didn't know that Solo was 29 in the first.
That's good because
I was afraid
that this movie was going to, like, in a Rogue One type way, that it was going to end very close to New Hope. And I'm glad to hear that that's.
Well, the fact that he got the 3-picture deal says that it's not going to end like a New Hope.
Right. No, like Rogue One.
Well, there's no way. The movie's not a 10-year storyline, is it?
No, I don't think so.
It's not. No, I think it's probably. It seems like almost like a heist movie. Like they're just getting the team together, and it's gonna be. I don't know. I'm excited. I'm getting excited.
I'm excited. Okay. I also saw footage.
Oh, confirmed. He is 29 in Episode 4.
Oh.
29 in Episode 4. He's 32 in Episode 5. 33 in Episode 6.
What nerd website did you go to immediately to find this out?
JakeHamilton.com.
I saw footage from James Wan's Aquaman.
Yeah.
At the Warner Bros. Panel. No, listen, Jake, hold on.
James Wan.
I love Wan too. And so this is the second time that I've been in a presentation where Wan, so the first time was at San Diego Comic-Con, and he was on stage for the DC panel, and he was very hesitant to show anything. He's always like, I don't really want to show this. It's not finished. But, and you've heard filmmakers say this before, and it feels like false modesty a lot of times. But in the footage that he showed at CinemaCon here, I finally get it. Like, he's trying to do something really, really epic with Atlantis, and we got to finally see it, and it looks the visual image to me that came to mind when I saw this underwater landscape of Atlantis was Coco's Land of the Dead. Like, it was just,
oh, that's cool.
It was sprawling, it was colorful, it was massive, and I understood now that Juan doesn't want your first image of this, your first look at it, to be concept art, you know, or unfinished CGI. So I can see why he's sort of hesitating on it, because the movie doesn't come out till December. But it looked so much better. It just looked, it looks epic. It looks like big screen, you know, big scale. I don't want to say Game of Thrones, because it's just a default to Momoa. But I think that they're going in the right direction with it. I kind of think that they're course correcting and putting DC on a good path. Listen,
my problem is I just don't care. Like, I just don't care about that character anymore. Right. I think, like, Suicide Squad, Jesus.
Justice League.
Justice League, yeah. Just sort of kind of ruined all the, even like, there. For, even that, like, there's an element of, like, the only reason I even care about Wonder Woman is because we're going backwards.
Yeah.
And we're getting 80s Wonder Woman. I mean, I can't help but just not, and I'm sure I agree with you. I think James Wan is a super underrated, incredibly talented director, and he's making a movie that I just, like, it's the equivalent of, to me, like James Cameron making Avatar 2. Like, I'm sure it'll be fine. Yeah. I just don't care.
Yeah.
I think the way James Wan moves his camera is incredible. I also think what he did with Furious 7 was just beyond, I mean, I love Furious 7. I thought it was, I mean, as a Fast and Furious fan since, you know, 2001, whatever it is. I will watch anything he does. Mm-hmm. So I'm all in. Conjuring 1 and 2 were very solid horror films. So I'm gonna see it, but I'm with Jake. I don't necessarily know that I want an Aquaman film. But I'm gonna see it, obviously. So I'm sure
there was a fake Variety article that came out. That you know, there's this like trend now where like a fake Variety Twitter account will tweet
fake
stuff out.
Yeah, I've seen those.
And and they tweeted out a fake article that was a Rickroll link, but the article was. Warner Brothers rebooting canceling all DCEU movies except for Wonder Woman and just rebooting the whole thing. And before I realized I was being Rickrolled, I got excited because I thought it was the right move.
Right.
I thought, good on them. Like cutting their losses. And then I clicked on it and then I got, you know, never gonna give you up. Never gonna, you know. But for a moment, I thought, well done. You're making the right move. That shows you my mentality with DC right now.
Speaking of not making the right move, or potentially not making the right move. Guy Ritchie is doing a live action Aladdin film for Disney, and they showed Will Smith as the genie in this behind the scenes footage. And I knew that Will Smith was cast as the genie, but I think in my mind I thought he was going to voice what would eventually become a CGI character. But it's not. It's live action Will Smith. Like, it's just Will Smith with a shaved head.
That worries me.
And baggy pants. And yeah, it concerned me a little bit too after seeing it, because they came out right off the bat and they were like, look, he's not trying to do Robin Williams. We're not touching that performance.
Which is similar to, like, if you've seen the musical on stage, that's what they do.
Okay.
It's obvious. I mean, obviously you can't have a CGI character on stage, but like, it's a man.
Right.
Sort of walking around. And I sort of felt that there is a little bit of the magic taken away whenever you make it just a guy.
That's how I felt
and
too.
And that's how I'm a little bit worried that that's what I'm going to... The same problems I had with it on stage is what I think are going to be the same problems I have with it on film.
Right. I don't know. We'll see how it plays out. I like Guy Ritchie a lot. I trust what he, what he tends to do. Yeah. So
I liked Man from U.N.C.L.E.
While we're on the Guy Ritchie note.
Oh my God.
Love Man from U.N.C.L.E.
Somebody brought up, they were like, what if we told you that there's a Guy Ritchie spy movie that stars Henry Cavill, Armie Hammer, and Alicia Vikander? And you could watch it right now if you wanted to.
Yeah. As many times as you want.
Yeah.
It's an awesome
and,
movie.
And it'll be like it's made just for you because no one else has seen it.
Yeah. All right, two other ones I saw really fast before we get to Avengers Infinity War. Glass, the extension of Unbreakable.
Oh, yeah.
This is M. Night Shyamalan, who is back bringing this movie, produced by Blumhouse. Extension of Unbreakable. At the end of Split, when they pan the diner and it lands on Bruce Willis's character, and you realize it's part of this shared universe that he's building. So we got to see the footage. It's this weird. It starts in a psychiatric ward where there's a psychiatrist played by Sarah Paulson who's specializing in candidates who believe that they have delusions of grandeur superpowers, and her three patients are David Dunn, Bruce Willis's character, Elijah Price, Samuel Jackson's character, and Kevin from Split, played by James McAvoy. And then it's about how the three of them interact and their different belief systems of whether they actually have powers or not. But it escalates into this huge confrontation between...
So the whole movie, they're in an insane asylum?
Not for the whole movie, but for a big chunk of it.
That's
for sure.
Awesome.
Yeah, for a big chunk of it.
Yeah, I
love that.
I like Split a lot. Unbreakable, I revisited it, and I still can't get over how well that movie was shot. If you look at the opening sequence in the train when the camera's going back and forth between the seat, I'm excited. I'm very excited. Split, yeah. I thought was good. I didn't love it like everybody else did. I also thought Split, the ending of Split heavily relied on a very recent viewing of Unbreakable. Mm. And I hadn't seen Unbreakable in over a decade by that point. So
half the people in my theater went, wait, why is Bruce Willis?
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. Like, right. You think people got to that reveal and they just were like, why is that important?
Yeah. Explaining the timeline of that movie is going to be like that in 2019 is going to be the equivalent today of trying to explain Infinity Stones, where like you've almost got to sit down with people and go, you need to listen to this because it's really important for you to understand moving forward. Like, I need you to sit down so I can explain how this works.
Right, right.
Yeah. The Split reveal was, it was a great idea. But for people like me who hadn't seen Unbreakable in over a decade, I knew what I was looking at because I know I'm not Shyamalan's films, but that was a very big risk. Obviously, the movie paid off and did very well, and I'm very excited that he's doing Glass because I think M. Night Shyamalan is a great director who's gotten a bad rap over the years because of becoming the guy who had the twist endings. But I love The Village. I love Lady in the Water. Well, that being said, I'm excited. I'm looking forward to seeing it.
This footage looked great. Looked like a great extension of that world, and I'm really excited to see. It was just great to see those actors back in those roles, and I can't wait to see. And McAvoy, I think, is a great addition to this. So Jake brought up Infinity Stones. I don't want to wait any longer. Let us discuss the movie that the three of us saw earlier this week. Kevin at the actual premiere in Los Angeles, and Jake and I in our various markets. Avengers Infinity War. Which I'm going to say, and I don't, that this is not spoilery, this is just my opinion right off the bat, is the best movie made by Marvel Studios to date. I don't think anything tops it. I don't know, for various reasons. Like, it's just the amount of stuff that it accomplishes, the things that it even tries to accomplish, and then actually pulls off. I'm still, the next day, I saw it yesterday, I'm still unraveling all of my feelings to it because it swings for huge, huge fences. And to me, crosses almost every line that I needed to cross.
Yeah, I mean, we're almost touching 3 hours with that movie. What is it, 240?
I think
it's the fastest, I think, that in a long time that amount of time has flown by in a theater. It's weird to say that it's a movie that's 2 hours and 40 minutes and that there's not an ounce of fat on it. My fiance was like, you know, joking earlier, oh, you'll be able to tell me when to go to the bathroom. And I said, there is no time to go. There is no time to go to the bathroom because you're going to miss something important. Something magical is going to happen. There's no way this movie worked without 10 years and 18 other movies building up to it.
Totally.
I mean, they everything that we get is earned. It's paid off at, you know, through a decade of work, through countless people, and it's really cool that, like, I almost want to, like, pat ourselves as, like, a fan base on the back. Like, hey, we stuck with them. Like, we, you know, through a couple of great movies, through a lot of good movies, and through a few mediocre movies. Like, we
don't talk about Ant-Man like that. Come on, Nathan.
Hey, hey.
Ant-Man's awesome.
It's no Die Hard 3, I'll tell you that. A little tease.
Not yet.
Yeah, it's an astounding achievement. Or let me correct myself. It's an astounding half of an achievement because it is half a movie. I don't care what Marvel says.
Okay.
It's part one of two.
That's fair.
I think what the Russos did here is just, it seems almost impossible for a lot of reasons. First of all, juggling that many storylines and that many characters and being able to actually pull it off with effort, it seems effortlessly. It seems effortless when you're watching the movie. Every single thing works. And as Jake said, no, not a single ounce of fat. Also, one of my biggest problems with movies these days is how they try to, a lot of movies try to dumb things down for the audience with exposition or over-explanatory shots and dialogue. This movie goes the opposite route, and it actually was a beautiful thing to watch. Like, so when we see some of these sequences, a lot of these characters have not met before. So when things are explained in the movie about what's going on story-wise, it makes sense why characters would be telling other characters that information because they don't know.
Right.
So to me, it worked in the story.
That's
and
fine.
It also helped. It also helped as a viewer to remember certain things. I've seen all 18 films, but to me, it was the most perfect use of exposition ever to explain story points in a movie because it had to be explained because Doctor Strange might not have known what was going on, or the Guardians didn't know who the Avengers were. So I think it's interesting that worked so well. Also, the action is so clean. I'm still processing the film, and I'm still trying to find out where it ranks in my MCU world. For me, Winter Soldier and Civil War, my two favorite MCU movies leading into Infinity War, this is easily top five. I need to find out. I need to see it again to process it. Though I will say there was a moment as I sat in that theater the other night that I couldn't believe what was entering my eyes.
Yeah, that's it.
And it's kind of a shocking thing to experience because we work so hard in this business as reporters to talk about movies. And to see something this exciting come along that legitimately shocks you and legitimately plays with your expectations. And Jake and I were discussing this on text. And then I'll get off my soapbox and we'll all talk. But one of the things about Jedi that I think I had a big problem with, I think Jake did too, was that the movie played with your expectations knowingly. I thought Jedi was literally saying, you think this is going to happen, so we're going to go ahead and divert it to this. I don't think that Rian Johnson intentionally did that, but it felt pretentious to me as an audience member. What happens in Infinity War is earned, as Jake said, but it's also, it's a perfect way to tell a story. The movie doesn't know it's a movie. To me, Jedi felt like it knew it was a movie. This does not know it's a movie. This is a story that we're just gauging and watching what's happening. And whatever happens, it never feels like they're saying, oh, you thought this was going to happen? We're going to go this route. It felt right what they did. So every frame of this movie is important, and it's definitely worth seeing. It's an incredible achievement, and I still think it's one movie. I don't disagree with the half thing, but I'll get to that in a little bit.
I want to build on what you just said, which is that I think it's become easier over time to just accept that what Marvel is accomplishing is, oh, well, that's what Marvel does, right? But what they've accomplished in this movie is actually impossible. It's impossible that we got to a point where there is a story that exists and all of these characters have been introduced to the point where they fit into the story naturally. Nothing is forced. We visit all of these places that have been shown in the trailers, and it
makes sense.
And it all makes it all lays out perfectly. And I a lot of that is the Russos, and a lot of that is Kevin Feige, and a lot of that every decision they made along the way. To the point that too, I would argue that Infinity War is one of the funniest movies I've seen in a really long time, and every joke rooted in character. It's all it's not punchline.
No,
it's things you're laughing at because you are so infinitely familiar with Thor, with the Guardians, with Spider-Man, with Iron Man, like it's a history that you bring to this movie, and it works.
This is a very dark film, and that's why it's interesting, because to me tone is the key to what the Russos did here. Ultimately, this is a very dark movie. It's very dark. It's shocking. It's emotional. It's hard to watch at times in a good way.
Yeah.
But they somehow infuse comedy at these moments that it's perfect. And like, to me, tone and storytelling and pace and structure are the hardest things a director has to deal with. And to build an exposition, to make jokes that work, to make things flow, to make things understandable to an audience member, I genuinely think that a person could sit in a theater and watch this, having not seen the 18 films. And now listen, here's the thing. The experience will be ultimately better have you seen the 18 movies and are invested in these characters, clearly. But that movie still works. You know who these people are. And you're also seeing meetings that are happening for the first time. So that all makes sense. It works. It works. It's awesome.
You know, on our morning show this morning, I went and pulled a clip of the very first after scene credit, or after credit scene from the first Iron Man. And it was just really this really humbling reminder of how far we've come in 10 years. Remember, 10 years ago, This May, in a couple of weeks, will be the 10th anniversary of Iron Man. And it was just this scene where Tony Stark walks into a room and Sam Jackson, who we didn't know was in the movie, says, "I want to talk to you about the Avengers Initiative." Take that and flash forward 10 years and look at what we have now. It went from an Iron Man movie. And I mean, it used to get to the point where, like, when we saw the Hulk, we would get excited if there was, like, a truck that said Stark on it. We'd be like, "Oh my God, it says Stark!" And now we have this movie where Iron Man is hanging out with Doctor Strange and Spider-Man. I mean, like, it's really... And I think Sean said this in a previous podcast. I'd never really thought about it until this point, but I fully agree with him. It's the most impressive accomplishment in the history of movies.
Yeah, it is. Because I can't think of what's close to it. I can't think of... No. Any other studio that is, and it's not that, because it's not like Disney or Warner tried to do it. It's Marvel Studios did it themselves, and they just figured out a partner to help them distribute it. And these guys, they have such a passion for the actual characters that.
Oh yeah.
And what it proves is that when you get to someone like Black Panther, who with all due respect is a B level, C plus level character in the world of Marvel Cinematic Universe. He's not Cap. He's not Iron Man. Yeah. But
dude, even Iron Man wasn't Iron Man when Iron Man came out. True. Like, Iron Man was no Batman or Superman. No one knew who Iron Man was.
Yeah, Iron Man. Yeah, that movie was a risk.
Yeah.
It was such a risk.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, I remember, like, Favreau and all. I mean, you see, like, interviews there. Like, no one knew. And also, I want to say one thing about the Russos. And to their credit, I had interviewed them at the Junket, and looking back on it now, I kind of wish I didn't. It's kind of a dumb question, but I was just basically like, you know, how do you top the airport scene in Civil War? And their answer, now that I've seen the film, is so profound, because Civil War, that scene is at the airport, is so incredibly impressive, but Infinity War just outdoes that scene as a whole movie. And I remember in the interview, their answer was, we approach every action scene as story and character.
Yeah.
So when you look at the vignettes that happen within the airport scene, it's all character-based. Everything that's happening is story-based. Every jump to each cut, each action shot is all story-based. And that was so profound to me to think that these guys, who, you know, have a lot to live up to with Civil War and Winter Soldier, took this movie with an ease of, we're going to focus on character, and then we'll let the action speak for itself. So, you know, any filmmaker could have been like, man, we got to top that airport scene. We got to do this. We have to do this. And I feel like that wasn't on their mind. I feel like their mindset was story. Yeah. And that's why Infinity War works. Because the action is so clean and great, but it doesn't overpower the movie. And I think
a bad action sequence leaves you with the characters in the same exact spot that they were when the action began. And all the action sequences in Infinity War, our characters are inherently in a different play. Even if it's a 5-minute action sequence, the characters from A to B, they use action to progress, like you said, to progress them, sometimes literally to progress them down a street or to progress them to a different place.
Yep.
It's not just, okay, like the movie's getting boring, so better like blow some crap up. Like it's like, hey, we need them to get from over here to over here, so why not do that in an exciting way?
Yeah. Any filmmaker will tell you the most important thing of movie making is storytelling. And like these, and there's something inherent about the weight of these characters, what they mean. I'm a huge Doctor Strange fan from the movie that Derrickson did, so I was so happy with the way they handled that character here. I know he was as well. Derrickson tweeted about that. I know we're going to dive into Thanos, and I think, I mean, this is a villain. To me, as you're watching this movie, and it is one of those things where, like, you rarely have this, because you say to yourself sometimes when you watch a movie, I think I saw someone saying this, but, like, when you watch an action scene, I think, Jake, you said this in your review, there are consequences, and, like, there's this legitimate thought that went through my mind as I sat in that theater, like, how can they defeat this guy? How is that possible?
Yep.
Like, this guy is so powerful, even when he gets one or two or three stones, whatever, because the whole purpose of the movie is trying to find all six stones, but it's scary. Like, I actually was scared in my seat.
And when is the last time you've been scared? When's the last time you've been scared by a villain like that?
How are these guys, like, I mean, we're talking about people that are beyond powerful. Like Thor, you know, the Hulk, everyone, like, Thor's a god. You know, like, in your mind, they build up these characters so much in these 18 movies that they're these all-powerful beings.
Right.
And then once Thanos shows up, it's like, they're ants,
literally
ants. We've all seen the trailer where Evans is hanging on to the gauntlet, and it's like that to me was just like a great visual of like these guys are nothing compared to the power of this guy.
Right.
So it is a legitimate feeling of like, oh my god.
Okay, well,
freakish.
Let's table this for now because next week we want to do this deep dive, you know, conversation where we can actually open
up. Can we give our ratings?
Wait, I want to talk about the ending.
Let's give our ratings for sure.
Let me say one thing. And Jake says something about Infinity War Part 1, Part 2 and how this is a half a film. I don't know. To me, as I watch this movie, I do understand that it leaves you wanting more for a next part. But to me, Infinity War is what happens in this movie. It's the Infinity War. So it is the war that occurs over the stones.
And let me ask this one question. Do you guys feel that the ending is unsatisfying?
No.
Okay. Then that's why I think it's fair.
And I didn't mean part one, part two, as in like, I was left feeling unsatisfied. Don't forget, they were originally called Avengers 3 and 4 were originally called Infinity War Part 1, Infinity War Part 2.
Yes, right.
And they've been doing their best to try to get away from that. But to me, like, I sort of get, and granted, we don't know what Avengers 4 is going to be about, but like, to me, Avengers 4 is going to be a continuation of the war.
Yeah.
But I mean, so was every other Marvel film. So Avengers 1.
I'd argue the other, like, Avengers films, like, are very, like, inclusive. They're very self-contained.
Clearly there's more story here and there's more things that need to happen and there's more things that are going to happen. But my opinion is that this was the Infinity War. And
I see
whatever
that
occurs in the movie is what happened because of the war. Now we go to the aftermath.
Okay. Well,
and then thing, you know what I mean? So that to me is what why it's so finite and so ending. You know what I mean?
Ricardo Hayes is watching us on Facebook and asks, now that we know that it's good, because at first we were like,
it's not
how
good,
is this
going
to play? Right. But I mean, like, what are the chances? What do we think it's going to open to opening weekend? Does it have a shot to beat the 247 that is the opening weekend for Force Awakens?
I don't think you ever count out an Avengers movie, but I don't think it. I mean, Force Awakens is forever going to be tough because that was a cultural movement.
Yeah,
that was a phenomenon where the world stopped and went, Star Wars is back.
Right.
And I'm not taking away from the fact that Infinity War is a massive monumental accomplishment in the history of cinema, but we also got a Marvel movie like 3 months ago, and we got an Avengers movie like 3 years ago.
This one's special, though, Jake. Don't you think this one's special?
Oh, no, no. Oh, it absolutely is. But, like, but is there, there is something about Han Solo being back, Princess Leia being back, yeah, and Luke being back.
For the first time in years. I get.
Whoa, whoa, wait. Are we getting dogs? Are we getting our dogs on the podcast? Because I can get my dog, too.
I don't mean to derail the show, but for people who are watching, I've been gone for a week, so my wife just got home, and I haven't seen my dog, so he was, like, whining down by my chair that I needed to touch him and pick him up. So I was just kind of giving him his attention, so I apologize. His name is Oscar. I know.
Hi, Oscar.
All right, last one. Brad Creason? I'm not sure if I'm sure I'm mispronouncing that. Wants to know if there are any new villains besides Thanos included in Infinity War, and I don't know if we can answer that, right?
I'm not answering that. I will. I mean, look, there's been news stories of actors and actresses who have been confirmed as villains in this film.
Correct.
But I don't think we should answer that at all.
I agree.
But I'll say one thing before we move on. I know we have the Die Hard thing and Tarantino.
Yes.
I want to give our ratings, but also just don't spoil anything for anybody. I've had people texting me asking me, does so-and-so die or whatever? And I'm like, I respond back with Thanos demands your silence.
Good.
Hashtag.
Good.
That's all I ever say. Cause I just feel like even though I've seen the movie, I feel like I have a responsibility as a film goer and also as a critic to not ruin that experience. I know people want to know, and I get that.
See, but I don't. I will never get that. I will never.
But no. What I mean is, I understand the want to know things that are surprising. But as a movie goer, like, I'm telling you, this is a perfect film to watch in a theater. I am going to buy tickets.
Yes.
Just to walk in and watch the last 30 minutes with an audience. I want people. I literally, people were shaking at the premiere, yeah. And I watched it with the entire cast. Nobody had seen the movie, and it was electrifying.
Yeah.
To a point of, like, I mean, Kevin Hart was sitting in front of me. He was asking Angela Bassett for autographs. Lawrence Fishburne was sitting in front of me. Sam Jackson was to the left of me. Whole cast was down in front of me. It was like, it was a very...
Did everyone stay seated through the credits?
No one got up. The only people that got up were security guards to get you out. And for people asking about end credit scenes, I'm not revealing how many there are. I don't know if you guys have or will. But just sit through the credits.
Yeah.
I mean,
you always know to sit through the end credits. Like, that's all you need to know. It's no different from any other Marvel movie.
I won't confirm or deny, but when the movie ended, my mindset was, I don't think we need an ending credit scene.
Right.
So the question will be, is there one? So when you see the movie, you'll see.
Okay, give your rating. Jake, give your rating. How many stars out of five?
5 out of 5.
Kevin?
5, no question. This year, Ready Player One is my number one. Avengers Infinity War is my number two. And it is... when we get into spoiler talk, I had some very minor issues, but they weren't enough to lower my rating. We'll talk about that when we get to spoilers later on. But I will say...
I actually probably think... because I'm sort of curious as to what it is, and I'm looking forward to it. And we'll talk after we're live. But I agree. I also have, like, a little twinge of an issue that I look forward to talking to.
I'll say one more thing, and I won't reveal what it is, but this film has the best moment of a major Avenger character ever.
Wow.
I know which one that is. It is the moment that this character was meant to have since the beginning of the MCU. It is...
I mean, I think Wong is an important character, but would you go that far to say?
No, but I'm not going to say what it is, but I'm surprised you guys don't...
I think I know what it is.
Well, truly, I can think of 5 that fit what you just said.
Every character has...
I'm going to text you.
Text me.
We're live, so we can do this, and this is fun.
All right.
I'll shake my head, yes or no.
Okay, I'm going to text both of you guys.
Okay. Go ahead.
But I will...
And producer Gabe as well.
My rating...
But I will say this.
Yes, go ahead.
Every character in this film has a moment. Every single one of them. Nobody outshines anybody.
No, it's true.
Except for Thanos, who's awesome.
All right. Thanos steals.
Performance capture on Josh Brolin. Every emotion on that face. Amazing. Mm-hmm. All right, Jake, did you text me?
Yes,
I did.
That's
texted everyone.
Yes, that is it.
Right, here we go.
That's mine also. Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah.
I knew it. Okay.
That is it.
Best moment for that character ever.
Gabe is shaking his head. Gabe says no.
Gabe
says move along. Okay, we also do a very popular segment. Oh, so Monday, we're gonna do our deep dive spoiler talk of Avengers Monday. So all you Real Blend listeners and fans who are out there, go see it this weekend. Come back Monday. We're gonna talk in depth about all the things that we love about this movie and where we think they're going to go for Avengers Part 4. We do a segment every once in a while called Unpopular Opinion. It is a topic that is brought up in our text chain that is so devastatingly, shockingly wrong to the other guys in the chain that we have to bring
this
into the
show. This is going to be so fun. I'm so excited.
But now we have to sort of kind of limit it a little bit because we also have to talk about Tarantino. So, but Kevin has said...
I got nowhere to be.
...repeatedly that he likes... Die Hard with now, so there's a debate about in general, the best Die Hard sequel. I'm always open to that debate because I'm a huge fan of 2. I think that 2, by the definition of what a Die Hard movie is, fits better than when they got to 3 and beyond, which took the formula of a Die Hard movie and took it in different directions of where I didn't necessarily agree with. But now Kevin came forward and said that he thinks Die Hard with a Vengeance is better than the original Die Hard, and that's where we have to fight to the death. So I'm going to let Kevin go first and just explain why he believes that. And I think that part of it is because you saw that one before you saw the original.
Yeah, and that is the case. So I have to give full disclosures. Die Hard 3 was the first Die Hard I saw, but I was also 11 years old when Die Hard 3 opened up. Right. So I wasn't even able to watch Die Hard 1 first. So to have the experience of a Die Hard 1 in my system prior to Die Hard 3, that might have been a different thing for me. Now, going back, I'm watching Die Hard 1. Obviously, I love Die Hard 1. I think it's an incredible masterpiece of an action film. Very, very condensed and focused in one environment, and that's why Die Hard 1 works so well. Die Hard 3 to me is a better film because I think it's a more entertaining movie just in general. Okay. I think it hits every intense note of what Die Hard 1 does, and the idea of just the sheer terror of what this person's doing. To me, Simon is a much better villain. I think Hans Gruber's amazing, but I thought the devastation that Simon, the things that Simon had Bruce and Sam do in the movie was incredibly intense, so well done. But I find Die Hard 3 just to capture, I don't know, McClane to me in that film just put through the ringer as he was in 1. So it's hard to say why I love 3 more than 1, but except for the fact that I would rather watch 3 than 1. But I understand that Die Hard 1's your favorite movie of all time.
Of all time.
And I get that. But I think a lot of it has to do with when I saw Die Hard 3 and then reverting back to 1. And I love 1. I just think 3 is a better film. I think it's a better villain. I think the action scenes are better. I think that the whole Central Park chase, the opening moment with Bruce Willis in Harlem, I mean, that scene is insane. Like you feel the pressure of it all. And then the kids in the school and I don't know. I just found that movie to be so much fun. I rewatched it the other day and just action and comedy blending so well together. But I'm also a Bad Boys 2 guy over Bad Boys 1. I'm a Terminator 2 guy over Terminator 1. I'm a Godfather 2 guy over Godfather 1. Wrath of Khan over Star Trek 1. You know, so I have a history of liking
most
sequels.
Of those are fairly common beliefs. Like you're, you know, it's, You know, Wrath of Khan is known to be better than Star Trek 1. A lot of people like Godfather 2 more than they like Godfather 1.
Empire over New
Yeah,
Hope,
those will
2.
Never feature in an unpopular opinion segment. What you're arguing now?
Actually, people think Terminator 1 is better than Terminator 2. I've met people that think that.
Yeah, but it's not such an unpopular belief that it would earn a spot in this. Someone believing Terminator 3 is the best Terminator would earn a spot in this segment.
So let me...
All right, but I want Sean to speak because, I respect Sean so much. I love the guy. I just don't feel the love of Die Hard 1 that he does. Well, so it's a bit of a more passionate thing for you, I think.
But well, here's what it is. I've thought a lot about this because to me, John McClane is a character who might as well be my father. Like I've spent so much time with him and have modeled my belief system after who he is as a person. And let me tell you why. Because I believe the order in which you watched them colors your opinion.
Sure.
Who John McClane is in the first 2 Die Hard movies is a guy who's in the wrong place at the wrong time and isn't supposed to be there and has to do the right thing because that's who he is, right? It's every ounce of his fiber. He, again, doesn't want to be in Nakatomi Plaza, doesn't want to be at the airport. He happens to be there for different reasons, but when stuff starts hitting the fan, he has to get involved.
Besides anything in Die Hard 3, though.
No.
He doesn't want to be there.
Nope. This is why I disagreed with a Vengeance from the beginning. They present McClane as this hungover guy who's being pulled into this charade by Simon against his will. Never,
but it makes perfect sense.
Never is McClane the guy who is standing up and doing the right thing in that movie because he believes it's the right thing to do. He is begrudgingly going through every step of that journey and with a vengeance, never wants to be doing it, ever. And I think that that's a huge flaw of that. Like, he always sees it as, it's more of he doesn't want to lose against this person, but he's not doing it for the right reasons. He's never doing it for the right reasons.
But if you were told to walk through the streets of Harlem wearing that sign,
right?
Could you?
Which sign?
I'm not saying the sign. I know what Jake's doing there. What's funny is Sam Jackson's actually in that scene, and Jake's whole history.
It's a whole thing for people that don't know.
It's a good thing. It's a joke
that's funny to like four people on this planet, and Sam Jackson's one of them.
What you're describing, like, nobody wants to be in that moment, and nobody is going to find a mindset of positivity to do the right thing.
Sure.
Meaning that when you're wearing that sign in the middle of Harlem, that's a death sentence. I mean, like, there is nothing to get you out of that moment.
Totally.
So to me, I think that was a defining moment. He clearly was hungover, as you mentioned, didn't want to be dragged into this. Simon is such an interesting villain because he did things that he knew John McClane would have to do,
right,
in order to. So I think it's the storyline that I think you have a problem with more than what John does in the
movie. Very possible.
Everything he does makes sense.
But I also think, and the scheme isn't nearly as tight as it is in the first two movies. The scheme,
you like it all in the building.
I prefer it to be all contained, and With a Vengeance doesn't have that intensity of, you know, being limited into your space by the time.
Sure.
And I even think, like, with a vengeance, I go along with the premise for the longest time, but by the time that they are like, Sam Jackson has to go to Yankee Stadium and find those, the sign underneath the tickets. And the scene that I mentioned in last week's podcast that aggravates me to no end, him surfing on the dump truck, which is one of the stupidest sequences I've ever seen in my life. And not only does he happen to get shot out of the tunnel by the pressure of the water and land in the thing right where Sam Jackson happens to be driving past, Kevin, you've been in New York City enough to know that that would never, ever happen. So, I mean, it's just like it becomes implausible after a while.
That you can't, but to me, like, that,
I
that's
fault
like
the
being,
movie for that. That's poor screenwriting.
I mean, listen, here's the thing. As I watched Iron Man the other day, it's a little long for sure. Mm. But I don't know. To me, it's the best Die Hard, specifically because of the interaction with Sam Jackson and John McClane. I also thought that everything Simon had them do was just edge of your seat intense.
Right.
It's a thrill ride. It hits every note. But I get your love of Die Hard 1. And I don't disagree with your points. I mean, I actually understand where you're coming
from.
Well,
and also, but the big thing about John McClane is he's a lone wolf. He's a guy who's supposed to do everything by himself because he's the only one who believes he can do it. So when you partner him with someone, that to me is like Lethal Weapon with Joe Pesci and Chris Rock. Like, hey, these guys aren't good
though.
Enough.
Okay,
Let's
okay,
bring in
okay,
some supporting
okay, okay,
guys.
Okay.
Right? A Die Hard... Well, first off, the script for With a Vengeance was supposed to be something called Simon Says. It was never supposed to be a Die Hard movie. Then it was refashioned to be a Lethal Weapon sequel. So that made sense to have two partners. And I just think when they took that third step to fashion it into a theoretical Die Hard movie, that's when the franchise, to me, lost focus of what a Die Hard movie is. But that's my personal definition of it.
I'll revisit Die Hard 1. And again, it's an interesting debate. I get most people think Die Hard 1 is better. Even Sam Jackson told me Die Hard 1 is better than Die Hard 3. So I asked him. I showed
Smart
him my
man.
Die Hard ticket 3 for 3. And he goes, I said, which one's better in your opinion? My buddies and I have a debate all the time. And he goes, Die Hard 1 is better than 3. I'm like, okay. I mean, the guy's in Die Hard 3.
He's in 3.
I disagree with him. Yeah. But I mean, it's an interesting debate. And I feel like my argument isn't as strong as it should be. Because I think I need to sit down and rewatch 1. And then we'll discuss it again. But yeah, as I sit here right now, I'm a Die Hard 3.
But also, and we can never change the order that you saw them. And I think that really does shape your opinion. And it's...
Oh,
yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah, it's fine.
But I saw... But it's weird. How do you get away from that? It's interesting. Like I saw T2 before I saw T1. Now, T2 is an infinitely better film. But would my experience have been different? I mean, I was born in 84, so I didn't see Terminator 1 until later.
I'll give you this as an example. My kids would probably tell you that Jurassic World is better than Jurassic Park.
That's wild.
Raising them wrong,
Sean. No, but you think that's crazy.
That's wild, though.
And
yeah.
They like Jurassic Park a lot. They just think world is better. They just they would make that argument. So use our Real Blend Twitter to weigh in on this unpopular opinions debate, please. Let us know who you agree with, and we'll take an unofficial poll on the Twitter feed. And actually follow us on Real Blend too. I don't do enough to plug the Twitter feed. I should actually tell more people that we have a Real Blend Twitter feed that we try to stay pretty active and share clips on things like that. A second game. We have two games in one show. I'm really happy about this. We do, traditionally, if you guys listen to us on a regular basis, we do a hashtag someone we love blend. And I have a really good one for next week, too. I think I'm really excited about this. I don't even think I told producer Gabe what this one's going to be. So last week we chose hashtag Tarantino blend. And then this was really great because yesterday during the Sony panel, or 2 days ago, it's Vegas. I'm lost track of time. Tarantino came out on stage with Leonardo DiCaprio and teased his next movie, which he's doing for summer of 2019, which is called Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. It's going to be set in L.A. in 1969 during the Sharon Tate, Charles Manson period. And he's going to be shutting down blocks of Los Angeles to recreate L.A. in the 60s. He talked about how he hasn't necessarily done a true L.A. movie since Pulp Fiction. He says Jackie Brown was shot there, but it's not necessarily his story. And so he feels like this is going to be a natural extension of Pulp Fiction, of just telling an L.A. story. And he was super excited about that, being an L.A. native. So we did Tarantino blend. And I'm super excited to talk about what we think is the best Quentin Tarantino film. And according to producer Gabe, I have to go first.
Wait, do we know if we... Should we know if we? Well,
we should. We should know. Gabe, give us an idea. Do we all have the same pick?
He's typing.
All of us have the same pick.
All three of us? All three?
Well, that's
okay. Maybe sometimes in the future we shouldn't know.
Yeah. Wait, can I guess Sean's?
Well, if we all. Yes, you can. Go ahead, Kevin. Guess it.
Sean, let me think. No, go ahead, Sean.
All right,
go ahead,
so I guess all three of us chose Pulp Fiction. And to me, it wasn't even hard. Like, this wasn't
Yeah,
hard.
It was easy. As soon as you said Tarantino blend last week, in my head I went, well, it's Pulp Fiction.
Okay, so, all right, so we can talk about how great Pulp Fiction is and what a masterpiece it is. How about we also do this? Is there one that was close for you guys? Is there one that if Pulp Fiction was out of the game, what would you choose?
Reservoir Dogs was my first choice.
Okay.
When you initially said Tarantino blend... Because I do think Reservoir Dogs, it's funny, I go back and forth, and I'm a huge Quentin Tarantino fan, as I know a lot of people are. My obsession with his films probably got a little weird, because I took Japanese for 2 years because of Kill Bill. I bought the Japanese Blu-ray or DVD of Kill Bill so I could watch the House of Blue Leaves scene in full color, because the MPAA made him turn it black and white during Volume 1. I mean, it's crazy. I went out and bought every single Reservoir Dogs color. I had the blonde DVD, the brown DVD, which was the signature Quentin Tarantino, like, limited edition. It was a bit of an issue.
How many copies of Reservoir Dogs did you buy?
I think I owned at one point like 6 or 7 copies of Reservoir Dogs. I remember getting...
cases?
Yeah. So Pulp Fiction, when Pulp Fiction came out, DVD, VHS, Blu-ray, whatever it was, I remember I bought the Canadian version to get an extra scene, I think it was. And then they released another DVD later on that had the Jackrabbit Slim's menu inside.
Yeah, I had that one.
And I already owned Pulp Fiction like 3 copies prior to that. So it was in my room had Reservoir Dogs posters, Pulp Fiction posters. It was crazy. Anyway, so Reservoir Dogs, for a long time, I thought that was his best movie. Just because of the direction of that film. The way he writes, the way he directs, the way he utilizes music. I think I ultimately went with Pulp Fiction because he tells his soundtrack is a character.
Mm-hmm.
Every song, like, I've never seen a movie that has taken a song from me, and then every time I hear this song now, it's Pulp Fiction that pops in my mind.
Yeah.
Al Green or even Jackie Brown with Across 110th Street. He makes music like a leading character, and like that's why I thought Hateful Eight was so interesting, because it was totally score-driven, mostly. There was some soundtrack in there, if I remember correctly, but it was mostly Ennio Morricone's score, which is rare for him, because he's very soundtrack-driven. Kill Bill had a mixture of both. But Pulp Fiction, I don't, is there a score in that movie? I think it's just all music, soundtrack.
What about that, like, huh, huh, huh?
Yeah.
Like,
yeah,
that was horrible.
But
you know what I'm talking about.
Yeah.
But didn't Black Eyed Peas take it and do something with it, like, 15 years later?
But Pulp Fiction's a masterpiece, because... I mean, you can boil it down to one thing. How do you make a scene funny when they blow a guy's head off?
Right.
Like, I mean, like...
Dude, I shot Marvin in the face.
But how do you find that tone? How is that funny? I mean, like, he finds these wicked tones in that movie. Pulp Fiction, by the way, I spent an entire summer taking every scene and trying to put it in order. It is fascinating if you put that movie in linear order.
Right, because the last scene would be Bruce Willis pulling away on the chopper.
Right. I'm trying to remember. I spent a whole
the
summer with
this. The first scene is them in the car talking about burgers?
I think so, because I'm trying to remember. I spent a whole summer. My wallet says Bad Mother Effer on. I mean, it's a Pulp Fiction, my number one,
you know,
no question.
You know what's amazing about Pulp Fiction is that it's these, what is it, three anthology stories, essentially, that it follows?
Yeah.
And they are the most unpredictable stories. You like from where they begin, you would never, if you got halfway through each of those stories and you paused it and turned to the person and said, where do you think this is going to go? You wouldn't come close to even guessing that the story of this boxer who has to go back and get the watch off the nightstand is going to turn into the car accident and the gimp. And you would never assume that the date between Mia Wallace and Travolta's character is going to end up with the heroin needle. Like, they all just go to these places that you could never wrap your brain around. And I don't think we had seen in a mainstream film anything that pushed the envelope nearly as hard as Pulp Fiction does.
Yeah. And by the way, nobody has ever shot a hamburger more perfectly than Tarantino. The 35 millimeter
burger.
Oh my God. The shot of that burger, it haunts me. Like, the 35 millimeter, it's so beautiful. It's sitting on this wrapper. It's breakfast time in the morning, and Jules and Vincent come in to take these guys out. And just oh my God, the sound effect of the Sprite, or the 7-Up, when he's like...
Also, Sam has never been better, right?
No.
In any movie?
No.
He never will.
No. That's the quintessential.
Though he and Django, he was pretty great in Django.
Great in Django. But I will, here's the thing. Pulp Fiction has affected my life so much. Every time I go to church, I pick up a Bible and I go to Ezekiel 25:17 and I read it. And it's different than, obviously, it's Tarantino added to it. But I'm like sitting in church, I'm like, reading Ezekiel 25:17, like, this is Pulp Fiction, this is so awesome.
But also think about like the impact that it made on movies too. Like, all of his movies are inherently love letters to movies. But one of the reasons that I gave Pulp Fiction the edge, for all the reasons you guys listed, but also I'd argue the only one of his movies that truly changed cinema. I mean, think about all the movies that came after Pulp Fiction. Then all of a sudden, everyone was trying to jumble up their timelines.
Yeah.
All of a sudden, everyone was trying to find a way to inject comedy into those really dark moments. The mid-90s were littered with, what was it, Go? And like so many different movies that tried to replicate what Pulp Fiction did.
Yep.
Because no one had ever, here's what was interesting, is that no one was quite sure what it was. And I think that's one of the reasons people weren't able to replicate it, is because it's, you can't really describe what it is and why it works so well. So because of that, you can't replicate it. You could inherently probably try to replicate Inglourious Basterds pretty well, which I'd argue, if we're talking about movies, that would be our second place film. Inglourious Basterds would be number two for me.
Yeah.
Most of his movies, you could find a way to replicate fairly decently. But Pulp Fiction is both a love letter to cinema, at sometimes shot for shot replicating some of his favorite movies. Like when Marcellus Wallace walks across the street, that's a shot from Psycho. That's Psycho.
Right.
You know, that's his tip of the cap. And the Gimp is a tip of the cap to Deliverance. It's a love letter to cinema while also being a movie that changed cinema forever.
My wife found this thing the other day, and I remember reading this years ago, but I don't know if it's confirmed about how they shot the needle scene in reverse. Have you ever heard this story? Like, they basically... Apparently Travolta did it in like reverse.
Right.
That way, because how else do you do that shot realistically? Anyways, look that up. I'm not 100% sure, but I think he filmed it in reverse.
How good is Eric Stoltz in that scene?
But you also have to like, Eric Stoltz, one thing about that movie is just everything about it is perfect.
Yeah.
And oddly enough, what I love about Quentin Tarantino, besides his musical choices, is his monologues and his dialogue. And my favorite monologue of all time is not even in that movie, which it was True Romance, which was Walken and Hopper and sequence. But he would say
which dialogue was that?
Yeah, we're not going to get into that. But the the opening of Inglourious Basterds might be the best directed scene he's ever done in his career, just simply because of the way the camera moved down the boards, the dust from the shots. I mean, nobody, Robert Richardson, one of the greatest cinematographers of all time, and remember Tarantino's editor for years, Sally Menke? Like, the editing she did on Pulp Fiction, and I think the last film she did was before Django. I think they had a new editor. I think she passed away. Well, but yeah, he is just...
Think back to... This is what cemented it to me. Like, it was already this incredible film. I'm trying to think back to the first time I watched it. And because of all of the places that it went and how good everybody was in it. But when we get to the diner scene at the end and you realize it connects to the beginning, which by the time we got to it, I'd forgotten that scene. Why? You don't even remember that scene is... Because you see so many other amazing things from the beginning of the opening that you forget that what the opening is. And then when you realize, oh my God, we've come back around to this, that melted my face.
Yeah. There's still
stuff
that...
Did you hear his theory about like... Or not his theory, his explanation as to... why he uses two different takes and why she says something different in the beginning than she does.
No.
So if you watch that scene in the beginning, when she gets up and screams what she screams, it's a different
what
than
she
what
scream?
She screams.
What is it?
If you interview
any of you
FM
word, P word,
move, I'll execute every mother effing last one of you.
Okay. And it's different.
It's a little different in the second time. And it's because he wanted a different perspective. He wanted like the second time is how
I didn't know that.
Vincent Vega and Jules hear it. And the first time is what she actually says. Because people ask him, like, why did you use two different takes? She says something different. And apparently he wanted two different perspectives. Because in that moment, like, if you were to ask 20 people, it's like playing a game of telephone.
Same
they'd all tell you something a little, oh, she said this. And someone would go, no, she said this. So that's what he was trying to convey.
That sounds like he made a mistake and is covering it.
Quentin Tarantino does not make mistakes,
He made a mistake.
I'm wondering if it was continuity. Because I never
now it's
even
mythology.
Noticed. But also, one thing that's interesting about that scene in the opening, I always wanted to ask him this, and I've interviewed him twice, but I need to talk to him about this if I ever interview him again. Why he stops her mouth in the opening shot as she's saying that line. Remember,
her mouth
freezes, and then the Dick Dale guitar comes in.
No.
But why? Why did I always wondered that. Like, why? I always wondered, like, why didn't he let her continue the words?
Right.
And there's got to be a reason there, clearly. He didn't just freeze it by mistake, but I mean.
Hashtag blend is not fun when we all pick the same movie. That stinks. I don't like
that. So if we all agree on his movie and we were going to pick his best scene, I say the opening scene from Inglourious Basterds. If you had to pick his best single moment.
Direction.
Yes.
Inglourious Basterds.
Opening. I say the, well, if we're all going to agree on that then.
No, I'm not going to agree on that. But I would really have to think about that. Mother of God.
No, there's nothing more masterful than that.
Maybe the massacre of the Crazy 88s at the end of Kill Bill.
No, I would say Uma's fight with the girl with the chain ball.
It's a great scene.
Yeah, but isn't that's the crazy? That's part of the crazy.
You're saying like the entire sequence.
That
entire sequence is incredible to me.
Yeah,
that's incredible.
Funny story. I'm a Kill Bill 2 guy over Kill Bill 1.
Oh, I don't like.
I don't look at them as two separate movies.
I know, but neither do I. But if I had to separate them,
do you guys want to? Do you want to know what our audience picked?
Yes, please.
Pulp Fiction. Hey,
yeah.
This week stinks.
You're killing me, Smalls.
You know what's
this week
funny?
Stinks and Inglourious Basterds. They said Inglourious Basterds also.
Yeah.
To Jake's point about Inglourious Basterds, I'll tell one quick story, and I know we have to go.
Yeah.
When I was first starting out in this job in 2000, what year did Grindhouse come out? Was it 2007?
Yeah, that sounds right.
I'll look.
So, Quentin Tarantino was doing a radio tour. That junket, if I could have sat in a room with Robert Rodriguez and Quentin Tarantino, I would have flipped out. But Quentin comes on, and I was working at a radio show at the time, and the guys, I was doing movie reviews for them, the junkies, and I was like, can I just jump in for one question, please? Like, he's my favorite filmmaker of all time. So, I get in the room, I sit down, and I say to him, I said, And now looking back on it, I feel like I worded it wrong. Because I said, Mr. Tarantino, I mean, I've been watching your movies all my life. Do you ever think you'll top the scene from True Romance, the dialogue between Walker and Hopper? And remember, keep in mind, at this point, Pulp Fiction had already come out, Reservoir Dogs had already come out, Jackie Brown had already come out.
Everything
Kill Bill
else
had already
you've done sucks. Will you ever do anything better?
No, he genuinely like got excited about it. He was like, "Oh my! Oh, you really know my work?" And he was like, "I'm working on a film right now, where I think I finally topped it. It's a World War II piece called Inglourious Basterds, and I think that I wrote a scene that finally topped that scene from True Romance." So then years later, I sat down with him for Django, and I said to him, I said, "You know, now that we're here and Bastards has already come out, do you still believe that you think the opening of Bastards is better than True Romance scene?" He goes, 100%.
Wow.
He goes, he thinks it's the best scene he's ever written and the best scene. Part of me, though, wonders if he had actually directed True Romance, would he feel differently about it? And he said on record
like because
a bunch
Bastards
of times.
Is his baby, so he feels a little bit.
Right.
Yeah.
I mean, also, True Romance, by the way, was non-linear. Tony Scott made it linear, and then apparently changed the ending. Quentin's ending, Christian Slater dies. I like both ideas of both endings, but yeah, I
did. Did they ever shoot that, or did they just straight up?
I think so. I think I have. I think it's on the DVD. I think I've actually watched. Tarantino never does commentaries, right. But he did one for True Romance, which I thought
that's
was awesome. Yeah, and then I think he did one with Hostel for Eli Roth. But I love Grindhouse too. I mean, I could talk about Tarantino all day. It's kind of crazy.
The picture you have of him holding the reel. What was that junket for?
Oh, I have that reel behind me. That was for Hateful Eight. We used to work at a movie theater, and a guy named Jeremy, who worked at the projector booth, he used to have the trailer sitting in the back. This is back when all the theaters had 35mm projectors, and he gave me the one that was on the front of Gangs in New York. It was I remember the Kill Bill. It says, "Don't show any PG or G movies." And it was the original trailer before cool. Weinstein divided it. So it ended on that Tricks Are for Kids line,
right.
And it was just Kill Bill at the time. It wasn't two volumes.
Right.
So that was the picture.
That's amazing. That's cool. All right, next week, your homework is we're gonna go actor again.
Ooh,
and it's the filmography of Tom Cruise. We're doing
hashtag
wow. Cruise Blend next week.
That's hard.
That's actually a mission that's impossible. I'm being serious.
Oh,
that
sucked.
It's going to be a fun
that's
one.
Actually, that's not possible.
It's going to be possible.
No, it's actually
and once
not
again,
possible.
And here's what makes it hard.
Right.
It's his best work.
Performance. His
best
performance.
Best performance.
Yes.
Not our favorite.
Not your favorite. So start
researching
now.
And that's what makes
now.
It hard. Because immediately my knee-jerk reaction goes to a handful, but then I go, well, is that his actual best work?
This, and Jake and I discuss this a lot,
right.
Like Tom Cruise is one of the most underrated actors working today because he's so famous and because of who he is. Like he gets kind of like put into this celebrity category, but you forget Born on the 4th of July and like Vanilla Sky and things that he genuinely has sick range. So does Brad Pitt and Jesse James and like 12 Monkeys and Fight Club.
Yep.
So I think a lot of these guys get so big that you forget how good they are.
And I have a great story for next week about sort of an interview kind of thing I did with Tom Cruise that I think is probably the greatest celebrity professional experience I'll ever have in my entire life.
Nice.
And it involves Tom Cruise.
It's
and it
awesome.
Is what I consider to be the all-time great junket. And it's essentially the tease is it's Tom Cruise saying, "I don't want to just sit in a hotel room and do interviews anymore." And what we did instead,
it's pretty great.
It will like I will die, and if it's somehow not in my top five greatest days of my life, then I just had the most amazing life imaginable.
Yeah, yeah.
That's what I'll say. That's the tease.
All right, you can find us on social media at Real Blend. So please follow the account and follow the actions of the show. Jake, you are also at
Jake's Takes.
Kevin, you are at?
At Infinity War Spoilers.
And
that's my Twitter.
I'm at Sean _O'Connell. We are on iTunes and Spotify and Google Play and all those great places. So please give us a rating and a star linking and all of that amazing stuff. Tune in for our next show. We are down for Monday, April 30th, live here on Facebook at 4 p.m. Eastern. We will be joined by managing editor Eric Davis over at Fandango, who is
a good guy
and loves
great
the Marvel Cinematic Universe. He's often breaking scoops on that beat and is going to join us for the spoiler discussion about Infinity War. All right. Thank you so much for tuning in to this week's show. And we will be back on Monday where we can discuss Avengers Infinity War spoilers. So get to the movie theaters and we will see you guys next week.
Dunkirk!
Dunkirk!